You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. You're on 95BFM. Let's go overseas for a bit.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
International desk.
Our go.
What the hell? How cool is that sting? Did you ever watch the Thunderbirds?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's one of my favourites. Anyway, today on International Desk, Nirvana Holder reports on India's carbon emissions and environmental laws.
Are India's environmental laws actually protecting the environment? Recently, India introduced a refreshed draft of a previously implemented environmental assessment called the EIA, or the Environment Impact Assessment. The EIA examines and assures a project's possible capacity to have an impact on the environment. The first draft was in 2006 and the refreshed draft took place this year and is titled as the 2020 draft. Given that India is the third largest carbon emitter in the world according to Forbes, the new draft raised concerns among the people during public assessment of the draft. The new draft enables projects to function on the basis of their size rather than their actual impact on the environment, which proves to be problematic as a small-sized project can have a very large environmental impact, which in turn affects the ecosystem and the individuals residing near such projects. Due to this, there were petitions circulating to re-evaluate the new 2020 draft. I spoke to Siddhant Prasad, who is a lecturer at Jindal University and is an environmental policy analyst. He talks about the environmental laws in India and some of the issues with the 2006 and 2020 EIA draft. Could you speak a little about EIA? There was a bit of stir about EIA in the recent few weeks, and I was wondering whether you could elaborate on what EIA is.
Yeah, well, the EIA is an environmental impact assessment. The basic idea is that before you do an activity which may have an adverse environmental impact, you conduct this study about the potential impacts of a certain project, and then you use that data you've got from the assessment and you factor that in your decision-making process in order to try and mitigate against those adverse environmental impacts. So it's a very essential step in decision-making, and without that step, you cannot really properly prevent adverse environmental consequences. So that's the theory of an environmental impact assessment, and you can see why it's so important. If you start to tinker with those laws, if you start to get rid of them, or you don't do them properly, then the effect is that the project or whatever decision you're making doesn't consider the environmental impacts, and you're going to have a very high risk that something's going to go wrong. Laws that we had in India, or we have currently, aren't very good. Let's start off there. You can find hundreds of problems with them, and if you compare them to jurisdictions like the EU, the UK, they're really not up to scruff. They don't have standards. Some of the rules are so complicated, even government officials can't understand them. Many of the provisions are arbitrary, such as the ones defining how far or how close to protected zones you can build projects. So the existing standards aren't very good, right? And the other problem, of course, is the way it's implemented. In India, what you get on paper is one thing and what actually happens in practice another. So to take one example, the current EIA law requires you to give 30 days notification before having a public consultation.
This is from the 2006 draft, if I'm not wrong?
Yeah, this is the 2006 notification. So this is the current law as it stands, really.
Yeah, that was essentially my next question. Would you be elaborating on the 2006 draft a little?
So one example of the 2006 stuff is that it requires the government to give affected people a 30-day notification before doing a public consultation process. So in that 30 days, they have to give to them a report, the environmental impact report, give them information about what's happening, what could happen, what the impacts are. And then the public has 30 days to go through that. And then after 30 days, they go and consult with the government and the decision maker. And then they try and come up with a solution. Now, that in theory is very good practice because you're involving those who are going to be affected in the decision-making process. You're listening to them and you're factoring all of that into the final process. That's even with the 2006 stuff. The reality on the ground is that this notification isn't taken very seriously. Sometimes notifications are given 10 days or 4 days before a public consultation, which is pretty meaningless, especially since some of these documents are so voluminous and complicated that 4 days is hardly enough time for anyone to come and read it. The entire process becomes a sham. There is no public consultation, stakeholders aren't consulted, and inevitably they're going to be harmed by that process. Now, what this new draft notification is doing is reducing that 30-day period to a 20-day period, which frankly doesn't make too much of a difference if you still stick to the rules. 20 days is fine. yes, it's 10 days less than 30 days, but if someone's going to comment on it, you know, 20 days is okay. I'm not saying it's good, but I'm saying it's okay. The real problem with the 2006 stuff and what's going on now is that none of it's actually ever implemented. So you're giving a report to people that aren't overly educated, sometimes in tribal communities, but you're giving them a 300-page document in language they can barely understand. How do you participate? There's no simplification of technical language. I'm not even sure they've proofread some of these things.
So none of it is translated either for the general mass to be understood, right?
No, probably not. Probably not. In some cases, they are translated, but in the vast majority of cases, they're probably not, because that requires an added effort. Now, you compare somewhere like the EU, and there's a rule in the EU that says that the language of the EIA, which you give to the public, has to be clear and comprehensible. That's something that doesn't exist here. Even if it did, well, I don't know how good they'd be at it. So the rules are there, Nirvana, but when you don't follow them, there's really not much point in them. And that's the stuff with the 2006 notification. There's tons of other problems, but they're all really of a very similar nature.
Yeah, this was an overview of both the drafts combined. But would you be able to point out a couple of views on the 2020 draft? Because after the 2020 draft was published, several people from the public decided to sign petitions around to like not the draft to be taken place. And I was wondering whether you could just point out the specificities of this draft compared to the 2006 draft.
Yeah, one of them I mentioned, which is the reduction of the notice period from 30 to 20 days. That's quite bad. The other one is that they have removed certain projects or certain types of projects from the purview of the legislation for certain parts of it. So, for example, projects that want to expand their capacity, let's say, by less than 50%, they don't have to go through any public consultation process whatsoever. If I have a project and I increase its size by half, which is quite a lot, I can take over 50% of that land and I don't have to consult the public, which is very dangerous because in any expansion is going to have added repercussions. So you really need to do that consultation process again. And by removing that process and by setting this arbitrary number of 50%, you're withering away at that safeguard, which was there previously. So that's one bad thing with the 2020. The third thing is that they have this strange idea of something called a post-facto approval. And they think it's a good idea to let a project happen, let harm occur, and then tell them that they've done the wrong thing, which is sort of pointless, as you can tell. The whole idea behind an environmental impact assessment is that it happens prior to the impact happening. It's a very simple principle of prevention, what you say in environmental law. If you start acting once the harm has already happened, then there's not really much point in doing it. So that's a pretty basic problem with this post-facto approval.
No, I understand it now. I was a bit confused about how it's going to operate in terms of like big or small companies operating on this.
Yeah, precisely. So it's size and capacity now, which, I mean, there are some other classifications, but one of them is size and capacity, which is that if you're, let's say, a very small project occupying a small area of size, not too many people, then you can go for this post-facto approval. The problem with using size and capacity as a proxy for environmental impact is that it doesn't always have a positive correlation, which means you can have a small size project, one with a very small capacity, but it can have a very, very large environmental impact. And there's tons of examples in India of really small projects which have had terrible, terrible consequences locally.
I was wondering whether you had some views about the petitions that were going on social media.
Yeah, it's good in a way, Nirvana. There's been a lot of focus. I think there's been close to 30,000 comments that have been sent to the government. But our experience with this type, I mean, I've spoken to some people that have experience with this, and they say to me that this is nothing new. This always happens whenever the government tries to do something like this, which is a small minority of people, which 30,000 is, mind you, gets very worked up about this, rightly so, and they petition the government, and it basically falls on deaf ears. The government's not going to read 30,000 petitions. We know that. We know they don't do it. And what they do is have some sort of namesake process where they pretend to listen to it, and then they just go ahead with their plans anyway.
Yeah.
So that's the experience I have with this type of movements and petitions. It's not a very promising thing.
Yeah.
I'm hopeful this time something changes. There is some greater form of pressure that's applied which forces the government to change its views, or even more optimistically, they have some day of moral reckoning where they realise that what they're doing is actually not very good.
Yeah.
But the chances of both of those things happening, I think, are rather bleak.
Right.
So we have to keep, I think, our fingers crossed and see what this amounts to. But if history is anything to go by, we can expect the government just to go ahead with it.
And that was Siddhant Prasad from Jindal University. In relation to the petitions that were circulated, I also spoke to a graduate fellow who is currently a MEM candidate at the University of Hawaii, where Bhavi Dwivedi started a project called The Final Stand while she was studying in Jindal University in Sonipat as a response to the government's legislative decisions on the environmental health of the country. You yourself have founded a little project called The Final Stand.
Right.
Would you be able to speak about the mission and the vision and the goals of this project a little?
It was something I founded in the fourth year of my law school. So this was in 2018, and I had come to the Supreme Court of Hawaii for an externship. And I actually did not realize that India's environment was as big of a problem as it is right now. And, you know, when I went back to India from Hawaii, that's when I realized that, you know, my health started getting impacted, because the air in near New Delhi, and that's where I was living, was just so bad that it was personally, it was impacting my health.
Yeah.
And that was the wake up call for me. And I started gathering people, and we were like, okay, we need to understand what is climate change in the context of India, because it's not something the politicians are talking about, or the mainstream media is talking about, because it's just not a thing right now, because we have so many other socioeconomic issues going on.
Definitely.
So, right. And I cannot blame people, right? Like, how do you blame people when there's just so many different things happening? So we basically wanted to create a movement of students, of young law students, being like, hey, well, this is our fundamental right to have clean access to water and air, and to have just have these basic rights. So we started gathering all kinds of legislations and just creating this movement where people were talking more about climate change and environmental degradation.
And how do you think the Final Stand, this project, be able to suggest these legislative changes to the state?
Right. So that's something I've kind of struggled with as well, because there's just the hierarchy and like the number of people you need to go through before even getting everybody to like talk about this, you know, or to even think about having a legislation. It baffles me, honestly. But I'm being hopeful here, because I do know that right now it's a really good time for people to start talking about these things. So even if we are unable to make a legislation, at least the Final Stand will be able to push towards one.
Definitely.
Like, just to push the government to like think about it.
Yeah.
For now, I think the project right now, as it stands, is trying to just create that grassroots awareness, which a lot of people don't have.
That leads me to the last question. Like, what are your future goals for the project?
To be honest, I am actually a grad student in environmental management in Hawaii.
Yeah.
So I'm not living in India anymore, but I definitely am in close touch with everybody else who has taken up this project once I graduated. So for now, we're trying to put together like a teaching manual that can be sent out to different schools in India, because like that's like the first step to telling kids that, you know, this is a thing, like climate change is happening.
Yeah.
Because people still don't know, or they deny it, you know.
Yeah.
So we're trying to do that. We're trying to bring in more students from across the country to understand what the Final Stand is about.
Yeah.
And to do that, we're also, you know, starting new blogs where people and young students especially can write about their experiences with climate change and what they've seen growing up, which is like in the last decade or so.
Yeah.
And so we have a blog, we have a website up, we're trying to start like donations if people are interested to donate, so we can buy the website name and we can like get into being an organization.
That was Vaibhavi Dwivedi from The Final Stand.
International Desk on 95 BFM.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.